From Cap Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Randall White. California was once the model in terms of flattening the curve when it came to, you know, curbing the spread of COVID-19. But now the state's numbers are spiking, and not just in terms of new cases discovered through additional testing, which we're certainly seeing, but also hospitalization numbers. During his coronavirus press briefing yesterday, Governor Gavin Newsom mentioned Placer County is one of the areas in the state where there is a concerning surge in cases.
In Placer County today, just 18.6% of their ICU beds are available. There's parts of the state, it's even less still. San Benito, 0% the ICU capacity available in that county. Again, an indication, county by county, that things look very differently than they do system-wide or state-wide.
Joining us now is Placer County District 1 Supervisor and current board chair, Bonnie Gore. Great to have you with us this morning. Thank you, Supervisor.
Good morning, Randall. Great to be here with you this morning.
So the governor turned the spotlight on your county, Placer County, showing your hospital beds are nearly 80% full. Did that come as a surprise to you, or you were expecting that?
Well, we've seen that our hospitals are full, and that does have to do with we have increased corona or COVID cases, but we also, businesses or hospitals, have had to bring in regular business. So the fact that the hospitals are full is not surprising, right? Because they're allowing elective surgeries to take place. So there are more people in the hospitals, but we have had more people in the hospital due to the coronavirus.
Your main hospitals in Placer County are run by Sutter Health and Kaiser Permanente?
That is correct.
Uh-huh. And both of those systems are allowing elective surgeries.
They are. And they need to. People have actually put off surgeries for months now. So folks who are waiting to get knee replacements, hip replacements, other type of elective surgeries, which sometimes are elective, but they still are needed, right? There's still a medical reason why they need these surgeries. And so those surgeries have taken place, which means there are more people in our hospitals.
You were, I'm not sure if you still are, a government relations director for Kaiser Permanente. Is that still your role?
It is not currently my role. So I resigned from Kaiser Permanente when I came to work full-time at the Board of Supervisors. And so I do have a background in understanding hospitals, yes.
Because I was going to say, at this moment, right now, being a government relations director for a hospital, how has that previous role shaped how you communicate during the pandemic?
Well, I certainly understand the challenges that the hospital has, right? I mean, they've got staff they have to make sure are safe, as well as their patients are safe. And we understand how important that is, right? So on the county level, as we're talking about people taking precautions, we need our residents to do that, as well as the hospitals are having to do that. And the hospitals are taking care of patients, but they also have a business to run. So they've got two sides to address as well, right? They've got to make sure they can make their bottom line, but they also have to take care of these patients who could contract the virus or have the virus.
Mm-hmm. If it gets to the point where the elective surgeries need to be cut off, do you think it is the state or federal government's position to come in to support the hospitals so they can continue to treat COVID-19 cases with those extra hospital beds?
Well, the good thing is that hospitals have surge plans, and our hospitals here in Placer County, actually hospitals throughout the state, put together surge plans. So if there are increased cases, they could be accommodated. They're on their campuses. So there is a plan. And I was just told the hospitals are dusting off those plans. So if there are surges, they can accommodate those patients.
So the governor pointed out the lack of hospital beds. In addition, Placer County has currently a 7-day average of 41 cases, which means over the past week, it has seen nearly 300 new cases of COVID-19. How would you describe the rise in cases locally? Is it concerning to the Board of Supervisors?
Well, it is concerning. Nobody wants to get this virus. And for those at higher risk, it is very concerning, right? People get very sick. So the number of cases has increased. And that's a challenge because we want to make sure that we can continue. We don't want people to get sick, We also want to be able to keep some of our businesses open because this is a balance, right? We've got a health issue, but we also have a much larger, well, we've got other health issues that are related to COVID, whether it's mental health issues, folks not being able to be out and active. And then you've got the economic hit to businesses and workers who no longer have jobs. So it's a huge issue community-wide, not just the health issue, but the bigger issues at large. So it's concerning. And we have to go back and say, folks, we need you to help be safe, which means we want you to wear face coverings. Please listen, wear the face coverings, respect people around you, maintain 6 feet of distance. Don't do large family gatherings. A lot of these cases have come from large family gatherings and households mixing together. And so we are asking our residents, and just like every other elected official in every community, wear face coverings, wash your hands, stay distant from one another so that we can control the virus.
I was just at a large store in Lincoln the other day, and I saw 100% compliance. There was a woman who was coming in as I was coming into the store, and she said, oh, like you could see she wanted to turn around to go back to her car. And then she asked one of the workers right there, oh, do you have face masks? And so that she didn't have to walk back to her car. And he's like, oh, yeah, we do, and handed it right out. So everyone seemed to be on board with the face mask thing.
Right. And that's good. It's not difficult. No, people don't like it. Of course we don't like it. And there are folks who are actively saying, I'm not going to wear it. Well, that can be your choice. But also those businesses can say, you know what, we're going to mandate the face coverings. And so in order to shop here, you've got to wear them.
Supervisor Gore, has there been any level of contact tracing done in Placer County to find out where this surge is coming from? Do we know if it's been from, you know, personal gatherings at homes or that sort of thing?
Yes. Yeah, so we are doing the tracing of folks. So somebody gets COVID, they're diagnosed with COVID. We've got staff who are trying to find out where it came from, who they've been in contact with. A large number are from family gatherings, household, large family gatherings. Probably, you know, we recently had Father's Day, 4th of July. People had parties. So a large number from there. We do have a number of cases in our congregate care settings. So a lot of our older, more at-risk seniors have been exposed in some of those congregate care locations, and that's concerning as well.
In terms of underlying conditions, Placer County is better off than much of the U.S. Statistics show that for diabetes, chronic respiratory disease, and cardiovascular disease, the rates are better than 75% of the country as a whole. So that's some good news. But you also have a significant elderly population concentrated in Lincoln Hills. Do these factors weigh at all on how the county chooses to move forward?
Well, yes, we do have a lot of seniors. What's very interesting is to look at the cases by age. And currently, only 10% of our cases are for people 65 and older. So our seniors have stayed home.
Right.
Our seniors in Lincoln Hills and Sun City Roseville aren't necessarily getting COVID because it's just 10% of our population who are getting those cases. And we have larger than 10% of our population who are seniors. So our seniors and then those at risk who have been staying home, and they are not getting the disease as much as other age groups yeah, are getting the disease.
So Placer County is certainly not the first county to experience a surge. Have you or any of the other members of the Board of Supervisors been in contact with other counties that have seen similar spikes to find out how they handled the situation?
I've spoken with a number of my colleagues in different counties, and I think we're all doing our part that we can is to encourage people to use safety precautions, face coverings, washing your hands, sanitizing your hands, maintaining social distancing. I think that that's one of the best things that we can encourage our residents, our community members to do.
Supervisor Gore, what's your biggest concern moving forward? Because you're at a point right now in the county where things could go very different ways. So what are you trying to avoid?
What we're trying, one is we're trying to get our kids to go back to school, right? If we can get off the state watch list for 14 days, which means if we can keep our case rates down, we want to get our kids to go back to school. We need to keep these case rates down so our businesses can open back up. That's really important for the community at large. And so that's the goal, is encouraging people to do what they can to help us keep that case rate down.
So participating in acts such as wearing a mask and social distancing, you believe in the end helps the economy.
It definitely does, because if we can keep those case rates down, we can open our businesses back up, right? Our gyms can open back up, and hair salons and tattoo parlors and dine-in restaurants. That's really important. Now, there are some options for some of those businesses, which is a good thing. Gyms are having people work outside. I guess now you can go get your hair cut outside,
right?
if they do some safety things. So that's a good thing, because I need to get my hair cut soon. But I think if we get the case rate down, then it will help us sort of get back to more normalcy, getting our kids back to school and getting our workers back to work.
Finally, Supervisor, let's leave this on a positive note. What are you most optimistic about?
I am optimistic. I think that we have a community that cares about one another, that wants the best for one another. And as I remind folks, it's not very difficult to be kind. And if wearing a face covering is being kind to your neighbor so that I'm not spreading potential disease to someone else, that's being kind. I may not love it. I don't love wearing a face covering. Yes, it's warm. Yes, it's uncomfortable. But if I can make sure that my friends and neighbors are safe, then let's do that. That's something that we can have in common. Let's do that and help one another.
All right. Former Roseville Vice Mayor, now Placer County District 1 Supervisor and current Board Chair Bonnie Gore, thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Thank you.
And up next, the issue of trust. As we seek out information about COVID-19, does your race play a role in where you get your updates? New research shows it does, and social media is a top choice for some groups. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, CAP Radio. I'm Randall White, and we are back in just a moment.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I am your host, Randall White, and our focus today is trust. So let me ask you this. How do you typically get your news? I'm going to assume, to some degree, it's from the radio or podcast because you're listening to Insight right now. TV, newspapers, websites, news apps, and even social media are all mainstream sources for information nowadays. CAP Radio and Valley Vision recently teamed up to conduct the most comprehensive pandemic survey of the Sacramento and Foothills regions. And one of the questions we asked was, how do you get your COVID-19 related information? Well, CAP Radio's Sarah Mises-Tan is back and joins us to talk about the findings. Welcome to Insight this morning, Sarah.
Hello, Randall. It's good to be here again.
Yeah, so this poll that we've discussed over the past week or so, it's a very, well, as I mentioned, comprehensive. So we've been digging down into different aspects of it. And today, we're talking about this. The poll found African-American respondents in particular felt a much higher level of trust in getting COVID-related information through social media more than other racial groups.
Yeah. So it found that 68% of Black respondents said they had some or a great deal of trust in social media, like Twitter and Facebook, in connecting them with information as it related to COVID. So this was as opposed to 31% of white respondents who said this and 28% of Asian respondents. Huh. So in contrast, it's a pretty dramatic leap.
It really is.
I thought it was kind of interesting.
And the margin of error there would really put the white and Asian respondents at the same level.
Yeah, mm-hmm. pretty much. Yeah, I think it was really surprising when you look at even the data that we got, just the raw data, Black respondents really do jump out in the social media category, which is why I thought it'd be interesting to dig in. You know, in contrast, both white and Asian respondents were also twice as likely to report reliance on government agencies or officials for COVID information. This as opposed to just 14% of Black respondents. That was also kind of surprising.
Again,
those two in tandem. And so there are a lot of reasons for this, but mainly experts say it's because for African Americans in particular, this racial group is one that has had high levels of distrust in more traditional forms of media or government agencies just from generations and generations of mistreatment. And these places not accurately reflecting their point of view. Interestingly, some research from the Pew Research Center showed that African Americans were also the group that was most likely to feel that traditional media did not understand them based off of race. So this rather than that they weren't understood as a result of other factors like politics or class or interest.
And we should mention that later in the show, we'll be speaking directly with someone from Pew Research where we can dig down a little deeper there. Sarah, we see that movements like Black Lives Matter have started on social media as well.
Experts say that higher levels of trust among African Americans on news gathered through social media in general is something that's been noted during any big political event, not just during the COVID crisis. So elections, the George Floyd demonstrations, these are both great examples of how this group is relying on social media because it can be like a curated talking space where they feel like they can see issues that impact them rise to the top and also where they feel like they can be heard. Here's Elisa Shearer. She's a research associate at the Pew Research Center.
I mean, it's not surprising that they've been following the Floyd protests specifically on social media more often, but they're also more likely specifically to have shared like content about race inequality on social media. So half of 49% said yes, and 39% of Black Americans, of those Black Americans, said that they had done it in the last month. So you definitely see a lot of activity among Black Americans on social media about race issues.
So anyone who's spent any time on social media knows that a lot of conspiracy theories can be spread that way, that it's like not always the best source for information. So I imagine, Sarah, you found some downsides to a group relying so heavily on information coming from this source.
Definitely. Yeah, I do think that this is obviously somewhat income dependent as well. I do think that, you know, when we spoke with people who were at organizations or public health oriented organizations, you know, they were more likely to say that they obviously did follow thought or leaders, government officials on Twitter. And so their Twitter feed did include that. But, you know, for someone who might be lower income, their Twitter feed may have less of that influence just because of the factors that we mentioned. And so there are certainly portions of the community in Sacramento that really do rely on social media to get important information about testing and safety regarding COVID. So on the ground, when larger government organizations don't utilize social media better, a specific and underserved portion of the population that might really need that news regarding COVID the most sometimes ends up missing out.
Uh-huh. And are there specific examples to the Sacramento area?
Of course. So Flojan Kofer of Public Health Advocates had mentioned to me that information like the pandemic EBT program, that was a program that would give children who were on free and reduced lunch extra food benefits during the COVID pandemic. This was information that was initially very difficult to find on social media. And in South Sacramento, when a number of COVID testing sites had to close due to a shortage of testing materials, many organizations that were running those community sites found out not through the Department of Health that they would be closing, but through news outlets. Here's Pastor Les Simmons, city council member, hopeful, and pastor at South Sacramento Christian Center.
I think we've missed out on important information when it comes to multiple things. But in this COVID atmosphere, we've definitely could miss out on information. It could come late. We can get it, you know, days later around shelter in place orders and what that looks like. We can get it days later, even weeks later when it comes to receiving resources from the city. A couple of weeks ago, there was a shortage in supply of testing equipment. So our site, along with a few other sites, got shut down. Well, in many ways, we didn't know about it till we saw it on the news that these sites were going to begin to get closed.
That's interesting. I actually found out about those sites being closed on my on a Facebook group. I found it through social media. So that's funny. It was the Oak Park Community Group. So.
Oh, interesting. All right.
Yeah, you know, just put a little twist on it, I guess.
Yeah, it really like speaks to like the how you can really curate your Facebook or Twitter feeds. And so, yeah, you know, if you weren't following the Oak Park Facebook group for whatever number of reasons, whether that be race or class or just interests, you may not have gotten that information. And so that's why I know, and Liz is kind of talking to just the importance of like larger government bodies, like communicating more directly with grassroots organizations that the community does really see as a leader in getting this information out.
Right. Cap Radio's Sarah Mises-Tan, I just have to say, you've done a terrific job reporting on the Cap Radio Valley Vision survey. And people can find just a wealth of data that exists at capradio.org/poll. That's P-O-L-L. Sarah, thank you for joining us over the past week or so with all of this.
Oh, thanks so much, Randall, for having me on.
All right. So joining us now to talk further about sources of information is President and CEO of the Sacramento Observer, Larry Lee. Welcome back to Insight, Larry. Good to have you here.
Randall, thank you so much for having me.
So as a newspaper man, do the poll numbers regarding where members of Sacramento area's African-American population get their information concern you at all?
It's not, it's concerning, but it's not news. And by that, I mean, you know, the history of the Black press, which is, you know, the Observer has been, was founded on those principles of the Black press, and we've been publishing for nearly 60 years in this region. But understanding that African-American needs are not being met through mainstream media is not a surprise. There is and has been a high level of distrust, as Sarah mentioned, through, you know, obviously through news media and government officials. And then particularly when you start talking about a health crisis, health challenges in particular, African-Americans really tend to skew much higher in regards to having some levels of distrust, and those are well founded, and there's some real substantive reasons as to why that has happened. Obviously, with just having issues like the Tuskegee experiment or other issues where African Americans have challenges communicating with their doctors and things like that. So the fact that we would go to other outlets to find that information is not necessarily surprising, because we've got to get the information, we've got to survive, and we have a community that has a tendency to help support each other, and so it's not oftentimes. And I heard you just say, you know, you heard about the shutdown of the testing centers through social media as well too. So it's a tool. As a newspaper publisher, it's concerning because, you know, obviously we take great lengths to make sure that we vet and be responsible with the content and the information that we provide to our community. So that does take time at times. And I was just talking to someone in my newsroom yesterday and said, you know, I don't really care that much about being first. I want to make sure that we're right and that we're excellent with the information that we provide. So
it's a great mantra, by the way. We use that here as well.
Yeah. So, you know, we recognize that, and I think it is what is part of the challenge for news media outlets in the 21st century is being nimble enough and agile enough to provide substantive content in the digital space. So that's the shift for newspapers, and it's all of them. It's not just mainstream newspapers, it's not just Black newspapers, it's all newspapers trying to make sure we find that place and space.
And I guess for you, you go to where your core audience is, right? So you could utilize, I imagine, Facebook and Twitter as a means to at least link to your articles.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's you know, kind of the path that many of us are doing, is trying to make sure that we re-reference our stories in social media and the like. But, you know, a lot of this stuff is Pandora's box, right? Once it gets out, you can't put it back in.
Right.
So it's no surprise, obviously, given the the results of the 2016 election, that African Americans tend to be targeted because of our reliance upon social media. And so we have to be very mindful and very diligent as our newspapers, since we are very much focused on the African American community and uplifting our community, that we stay on top of it. But it also speaks to I don't know how I'm on time, but it also speaks to a challenge that many of our media outlets have with government and the dissemination of information,
right?
Of itself.
Please talk about that, because I have that as a question for you.
When you're dealing with, particularly, I don't want to speak too disparagingly about, our local government, but when we talk about the city and the county of Sacramento, there are real challenges with getting information out and getting them to respond to us in a responsible manner that allows the information to get out. We have been in discussions with county officials on an ongoing basis. It started with an open letter that we had to that the Observer helped pen with the county and city officials about the dissemination of information. We've had the county, and some great things have come from it. To be honest, the expansion of many of the testing sites into communities of color and underrepresented communities have come out of those meetings, as well as even like some of the job opportunities that are coming with the reopening navigators. Those came out of our meetings with them. But I will say, both the city and the county have struggled with trying to find out how they utilize their resources to make sure that there is a proper information marketing campaign that speaks to this moment that we're in regards to this pandemic.
Yeah.
There's no real understood outreach plan by either organizations right now. And that's a little concerning, because it speaks to, those things that Pastor Les and Dr. Flo mentioned, in regards to that, because that information has got to get out. And we are now in a moment. I mean, we're 4 or 5 months into this pandemic, and, there's no real understood message about protecting our communities. And we're talking about life and death. I mean, our office is on Del Paso Boulevard. We're right in the middle of our community. And I see our community not being well informed or educated about, everything from wearing masks and social distancing and all these things. So there's a segment of the community that social media is really never going to touch. It's those that are maybe unhoused, with low income, don't have access to digital and social media. And so there has to be an extra step when we're talking about really trying to save people from themselves in reality.
That's the voice of Larry Lee, president and CEO of the Sacramento Observer. And you mentioned the pandemic, which is running concurrently with a major social shift that we're seeing, an awareness by many people. A recent poll that I just saw this morning shows that a majority of Americans, regardless of race, are now supportive of the Black Lives Matter movement. Do you feel that this shift could also affect where members of Sacramento's African American community get their news sources? Might it shift their trust levels toward more mainstream outlets?
I wouldn't necessarily say that. I mean, I know that there's definitely, I call it a moral awakening. I wrote a piece a couple of weeks ago in regards to that, because there has been a moral awakening by those outside of the African American community that recognize that, the conditions that have been impacting our community literally for hundreds of years and generations really are having an effect on not just our community, but this nation as a whole. But I wouldn't necessarily think that there is necessarily a shift in media consumption for the African American community. Now, what I will say, because we're starting to notice it a little bit, is we're seeing a shift in those outside of our outside of the African American community subscribing to the Observer, right? So we've received a little bit of a bump from some zip codes that we would not normally see, which has been encouraging, because I think that there is some understanding that you know, this community has for many years gone unheard. Obviously, protests, as Dr. King said, are often the results of the voice of those that have not been heard. And so I think that there is definitely an awareness of that. Now, in regards to, you know, those outside of, I mean, our community kind of reaching out to other media outlets, I think there's definitely a need for more mainstream media outlets to have their newsrooms be more diverse. That has been a fight that many of us in our industry have been fighting for. I've been fighting it for my entire life. The Observer and my dad helped The Bee get its first Black reporter in the newsroom. And I was talking with Lauren Gustus, the publisher of The Bee, just last week. And, you know, we were talking about the new initiative that The Bee has with trying to bring some more African-American reporters into their newsroom. It's an ongoing challenge. And as I told her, I said, we are here standing to help them with that. I mean, obviously, we want the best and the brightest journalists, Black journalists in our newsrooms, but it's still very important that mainstream media outlets diversify their newsrooms. They've got to make that, we've got to have our voices in these newsrooms, because they're not going to go away. I mean, you know, you could say what you want to about mainstream media. It is very challenged, and they are having a very difficult time. I would say much harder time than we are as far as being nimble. But, you know, we've got to make sure that we have those voices in those newsrooms, and not just token voices of you know, a reporter here or there, but we got to have decision makers, editors and executives in these positions that can help help change their trajectory.
President and CEO of the Sacramento Observer, Larry Lee, thank you so much for joining us this morning and giving us insight into your work and how things might be moving forward.
Thank you so much again, Randall. Thank you, Capital Public Radio. You guys keep up the good work.
Oh, thanks a lot. All right, coming up, what recent research by Pew can tell us about how well the media is trusted and what's driving those perceptions. Also, if any of the reporters at Cap Radio understand the concept of trust better than others, that would be our PolitiFact reporter, Chris Nichols. He's here to talk about trusting social media and what it means to place trust in health experts and government officials. You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. Great to have you with us this morning. I'm Randall White. We're back in just a moment.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Schlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Randall White. We're discussing the concept of trust this morning and how that fits in with our consumption of news and information surrounding the coronavirus pandemic. One highly trusted source for information about how we behave is the Pew Research Center, so we thought we'd tap them to give us some insights into this topic. Lee Rainey is the Director of Internet and Technology Research at Pew. Great to have you with us this morning. Welcome to Insight.
Thanks so much, Randall.
So, Lee, what did the findings show in terms of intrapersonal trust among those who were more highly educated and those who were not in a recent survey that you did?
We've been looking at trust for a long time, and Pew has documented the same thing that many organizations have found, that in the past generation or a little bit longer, there's been a steep decline in trust in lots of institutions. But there's also been a sort of similar sad story on the side of interpersonal trust. Americans are somewhat less trusting of each other than they used to be. And there is a sort of well-established way to measure that. And so just at the dawn of the coronavirus outbreak, we re-asked those questions about interpersonal trust. And there are three questions that anchor those judgments. One of them changed at the dawn of the outbreak. So the question is, would you say that most of the time people try to help others or just look out for themselves? A majority of people still think in America that people just look out for themselves, but there was an uptick in the number of trying to help others. About 42% now were saying at the time, early April, that the inclination of people to help each other, they perceived that it was on the rise. The other two questions relate to general trust. Can people can be trusted or not? And that's about a 50-50 this decision among adults in this country. About half say people can be trusted, about half say the other thing. And the second question is a little bit more downcast and doleful. Do you think most people would try to take advantage of you if they got the chance, or would they try to be fair no matter what? And about 55% of people say take advantage rather than try to be fair. And there's a way that, you know, your question implied, how are the two things related? Do people sort of have the same feelings about institutions as they have about each other? And there's a pretty tight correlation. The more trust you have in others, the more likely you are to trust institutions. So there's a there are two sort of parallel stories going on here that actually intersect with each other in important ways.
I love how Pew will repeat questions over the decades and then show you a graph of, you know, people's trust levels and those sorts of things, breaking it down. In terms of this 55% who think that someone is more likely to take advantage, has that remained steady or has that ticked up over the years?
It's been pretty steady for a long time. The interpersonal trust judgments that people make don't vary as much as the institutional judgments they make. Of course, one of the most interesting things that's been going on in the pandemic is that the polarization of the culture is now showing up in the kinds of sources that people are turning to as they get information. So in recent Pew data, we found that people are feel pretty good about the CDC, about their local medical authorities, about their local hospital officials, about state and local officials providing them information. But there has been a bit of a downturn in people saying that they trust the president and his administration for information on this. So it speaks to the, you know, I think what you're talking about throughout the morning, about a balkanized media culture where people have their own favorite sources of news. There are definitely news sources that people say they like. They're different depending on where who they are and where they live.
Right.
But there is now no longer this sense that there's a sort of common ethic in and common source of information in national news media, mainstream news media, that's become a lot more polarized over time.
Do you think trust is something that's hardwired into us, you know, maybe more nature than nurture? I see that your poll finds about a third of Americans register low levels of trust compared with 29% who are high trusters and 32% who are medium trusters. So it looks like we've got these like three categories that are roughly equal. And I'm wondering, is that just the way we are? You know, like you're born a truster or a high truster.
When you ask people about trust, they will talk very much about its the conditions under which they trust and the conditions under which they don't trust. So trust is not genetically based, so you're all trusting or you're all distrusting. It really depends on who you're investing your trust in, what the investment involves. If it's a life or death decision, people think about it differently than if it's a website that's going to give them a couple of cents off on a gift they're going to buy or right. Something like that. So there's a real contingent nature and conditional nature to the way people think about trust, which is makes it a really complicated and really interesting thing to study. But it is definitely not the case that you know, forever and always, it's been a third of the population. There have probably been rises and falls, and particularly right after World War II and the Great Depression, there was much more generalized trust throughout society, both in the institutions that were created to serve people as well as other people. Robert Putnam has well documented that in his Bowling Alone book. And then starting in the 60s and particularly accelerating in the 70s and 80s, there was this collapse in trust in institutions as life got complicated again.
Right. Lee, you mentioned trust in leadership all the way up to the federal level. I'm wondering if you have data that indicates our trust in, the healthcare system, and if that depends on who we are, where we live, sort of thing.
Yeah, and almost always it's the case that if you ask people about the local scene versus the national scene, they know the local scene, or they have their favorite doctor or hospital or smart friend who's a health specialist or things like that. So people almost always feel more comfortable and more trusting in a local environment than a national environment. But even in the case of broad dimensions of the health system, if you're asking about national institutions like the CDC, you get slightly different readings from what you get about state health authorities and local health authorities. So again, people are making pretty nuanced judgments that are quite conditional, depending on what you're asking about and what the stakes are.
Lee Rainey is the Director of Internet and Technology Research at Pew. Just terrific information. I appreciate it, and I hope we get to have you back on soon.
I would love that. Randall, thanks so much.
Thanks for being here. Enjoy the rest of your day. Cap Radio's PolitiFact California reporter Chris Nichols joins us now. And we put a lot of trust in Chris here at the station because, it's his job to find out who we shouldn't be trusting. And he does that well. Chris, tell us about a survey published last November by the Associated Press. Of course, that's pre-pandemic. I always look at all of these things as pre and post-pandemic because people's opinions change based on that.
Hi, good morning, Randall.
Yeah, good morning, Chris. Hey, can you tell us about this survey published last November by the AP that found only 11% of Americans say they trust information about the government that they see on social media? Either a great deal or quite a bit.
Sure. And I think this is a report that really shows the contradictory relationship that a lot of Americans have when it comes to their reliance on social media. We say that we don't really trust it, but yet we go there for news. We tend to rely on it. So as you said, only 11% say they trust information about government they see on social media, either a great deal or quite a bit. Two-thirds said they had little to no trust in that information, but yet that same survey shows that 54% of Americans say they get government-related information from social media at least once a day, more than newspapers, more than TV, or any other source.
And one aspect of your job here at Cap Radio as our PolitiFact California reporter is to call out misinformation on social media. We have Cap Radio has a partnership with Facebook, right? Explain to us how that works.
We do. This is a new partnership, and the goal is really to do something about that relationship that I just talked about, to try to help when it comes to trust in the information people are seeing, to know that they are getting correct information. So we've partnered with Facebook to help knock down some of the false information they see on social media to show what's true, what's not. Here's a reminder of how that partnership works. Facebook contracts with independent news organizations such as the Associated Press, our national partner PolitiFact, to fact check false information in these posts on Facebook and Instagram. Cap Radio is now one of these news organizations partnering with Facebook. And we use our PolitiFact California initiative to do this. We have all of our fact checks at both capradio.org and politifact.com/California. Now, Facebook does not tell us what to fact check. They don't have a say in our process, but they do make a database available to us. We can see which Facebook posts are being flagged by users, which ones are being flagged as questionable. And then we can see which ones of those posts are being shared thousands and thousands of times. And our goal is to fact check the ones that have been widely shared and have some connection to California.
Chris, what does Facebook then do with your findings? You know, if you find something is a pants on fire, like is as untrue as it can possibly be, does Facebook then restrict that from appearing on the platform?
They do. And so there are real concrete impacts of what we do with these fact checks. Once we publish the fact check, Facebook will add a warning label to the post in question. And when someone goes to share it, share that post, a message will pop up saying independent fact checkers say this post has false information. It will show them a link to our fact check. It'll ask them whether they still want to share that post anyway. And if they do, our fact check travels along with that post, and that warning also goes with it so that people can at least see that independent fact checkers, independent journalists have said there is false information here.
Yeah. All right. Let's, if it's okay with you, let's highlight a little bit of your recent work then. Give us an example of one of these Facebook fact checks that you recently did.
Sure. We focused a lot on the misinformation out there about COVID-19, about wearing masks. There was one post that we checked recently, again, widely shared. It was claiming that mask wearing is leading to fungal lung infections. And medical experts told us they are seeing absolutely no evidence to support that. We rated that one false. Again, a warning label was put on that post, and our fact check was attached right to it.
So, Chris, Facebook has been criticized for not doing enough to stop hate speech and harmful content on its platform. Until recently, it has resisted even adding warning labels on ads from places like President Trump's campaign or the campaign of former Vice President Joe Biden, regardless of whether there was false information in the ad. What's changed there?
That's right. Traditionally, Facebook has just really said it would not remove this content. That's been a key position they've held for quite a while, saying that speech from politicians, even if it violated certain policies that maybe someone else's post might be flagged or taken down, that speech from the politician was newsworthy. They didn't want to appear as censoring the news. But last month, Facebook's chief executive, Mark Zuckerberg, said on a live stream, the company will now remove posts that incite violence or attempt to suppress voting, even from political leaders. And they said that the company will also add those warning labels to posts that violate hate speech or other policies. I believe we have some sound from Mark Zuckerberg.
If we determine that content may lead to violence or deprive people of their right to vote, we're going to take that content down no matter who says it.
And that, again, was Mark Zuckerberg. And a lot of the recent criticism, Chris, of Facebook took place after the company decided not to label or remove a post by President Trump that said, what did it say?
It said, when the looting starts, the shooting starts. And that was right in the middle of the George Floyd racial justice protests. It was obviously a very controversial post. Twitter did act and added a warning label to that comment from the president, saying it was glorifying violence. Facebook did not, created a big controversy. And I think we should point out that Facebook's policy change only comes after quite a few national brands pledged to stop advertising on the social network until it does more to curb hate speech and harmful content.
And it's entirely up to Facebook to decide what to do with a post, right?
That's right. And I think that is going to be something people disagree with. You know, it's their platform, it's their policies. There's been a lot of pressure added to them, but it'll be up to their discretion to decide when a post actually violates one of these policies, and they just might see that information as different from others.
And earlier this month, the Washington Post reported that Facebook is considering some more movement along these lines, maybe later in the year.
That's right. There was sort of a possibly dramatic move that Facebook is considering, at least according to the Washington Post. The Post reported that Facebook executives are considering a temporary ban on political advertising in the final days before the U.S. election in November.
Wow.
And the Post cited two people familiar with the company's thinking. They reported, however, that no final decision has been made on that idea.
All right. Cap Radio's PolitiFact reporter, Chris Nichols. Chris, thanks for joining us this morning and for all of the work that you do along these lines. I think it's one of the most important jobs we have here at the station.
Thank you, Randall. I appreciate that.
And anything you heard here today, or if you want to go back and listen again to the podcast version, you can find it at capradio.org/insight. That is Insight for today. I'm Randall White with producers Cynthia Lopez, who did a lot of work on today's show, and Kyle McKinnon. Our digital team, Chris Hagen, Emily Zentner, Helga Salinas, and Chris Farah Phillips. That's Insight for today. We'll see you again tomorrow.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.